On Yom Ha'atzmaut in Gush in the morning, Rav Lichtenstein would give shiur after breakfast. And I was not someone who was all that interested in seeing the rest of the world at that time. It was not necessarily a good thing. So I had nowhere in particular to go on Yom Ha'atzmaut. So my year's there, I stick around for the shiur. He gave shiur on Zra'im on Yom Ha'atzmaut. Partly, I think, because of Mitzvot HaTzliyot Ba'aretz, focus on Eretz Israel, and partly because there were only about 20 people there, so he could sort of cut loose and do something wild and talk about sugyot that no one had ever heard of. Now, if Megillat Ta'anit were around today, obviously Yom Ha'atzmaut would not only be on the list, but it would be one of the more major days that were Delal Mispeid, Noah Espeidim. In any event, that was not my job is not to speak about Rav Lichtenstein, but we as ZYU community, as a Zionist community, suffered a colossal loss this week, and I think it would be unfair to not say something at the beginning about how Rav Lichtenstein colors my thinking, at least, and I think the thinking of anyone who comes to study Torah on Yom Ha'atzmaut. So with your permission, I'll share just a few thoughts before getting into the shiur itself. I spent 3 years at Yeshivat Har Etzion, and the first two in particular were probably the single most formative experience in my life. For the first time, I saw the value of studying Torah for as long as one could physically hold out, and understood, probably more importantly, what it meant to have a worldview. Even if I've never quite succeeded in developing my own, I appreciate the importance of a worldview, and appreciate what it means for someone to be animated by seeing the world through lenses. I was in a Lichtenstein chair for quite some time. By personality, I'm not someone who ever sought him out for a lot of conversations, and in any event, I'm not sure that particular stories that I happen to witness are any more valuable than anything else that anyone can say. On the other hand, I certainly can't say that I have the measure of the man. So I can't try to step back and give you a portrait of who he was either. What I'd like to do instead is to just identify two ways in which Rav Lichtenstein is a guidepost for me, and I think really for everyone in the community. The first one is the management of time. A number of people that I've heard even this past week have talked about how he was constantly running, and there was no time for anything. That's a misconstrual of what he did. He often ran, but he was certainly not always running. Actually, much of his time was sat sitting in place. His zitzfleisch was legendary. He could just sit there, total silence, absolute concentration, for hours on end. Certainly in his earlier days, you can't actually master Shas, Poskim, and English literature by running. And even in his later days, when there were untold number of responsibilities and people asking him for things, as I'm sure you've seen or heard, he would sit quietly unless there was something to run to. And that's really the point about time management. He reported that he used to learn night seder with his kids when they were in the Tiv Meir. And at some point, one of his sons, Rebbeim, asked him, said, "You know, Rav Lichtenstein, I can't find time to learn with my kids, and you have many more responsibilities. How is it that you're here twice a week for an hour and a half?" And Rav Lichtenstein said something incredibly concise, and I think very important. He said, "It all depends what you put on the schedule first." And that's what I mean by time management. It's not just a question of, here's my list of responsibilities, how do I put them in order? It's first of all, what responsibilities am I going to take? What's first? What's negotiable? What, if it doesn't have to happen, it won't happen. But what has to be there on the calendar before anything else happens? When he sat still, it wasn't because there was nowhere to run to. It's because he had decided that this was something worth sitting still for. That was something that anything else had to take a back seat at this point. But of course, you have to think carefully about priorities and values in order to make a decision like that. When he was still at YU, he would supposedly bring his shiur on occasion on Sundays to protests, especially down at the UN, not about Jewish issues in particular, but global issues that he thought were of paramount importance for Jews to take a stand on. I don't think this is about Vietnam in particular, although he's very outspoken about the Vietnam War against. But of course, if there was a protest at the UN at 11 a.m., that couldn't mean that Scheer wouldn't happen. So Scheer simply happened at 7 in the morning. So it could be done by 9, and everyone could get down to the UN by 11 for the protest. All that brings me to the second, and I think more challenging point for me. Rilakanthina is someone whose erudition I don't need to say anything about. It's staggering how erudite he was. But he serves as a model for whom erudition had to have a purpose. It was knowledge in the service of something. It was true to some extent in Torah, but it was true even more with other realms. Once I did ask him a question, I approached him with the suggestion that sugyot such as zenenev zelo chaser, when the Gemara rules that you don't have to pay, or kofin al midat stone, establish. I don't know exactly what I said. I said it way too radically. I said something like, you know, doesn't that prove that the Torah is anti-capitalist or something of the sort? And he resisted, you know, my youthful formulations, but said, you know, there's something to that. I've written about that. And he said, I wrote an article in a volume a long time ago. And he told me the name of the volume. And he said, it's in the library. You can find it. So, of course, I couldn't find it. I couldn't remember what he had said. Came back. After 3 or 4 trips, I was able to find the book and discovered that back in the 60s, late 60s, he had been working on papers that were massively erudite. That doesn't surprise, but always impresses. But more important, he had taken a sugya with his vast knowledge of Gemaras and Rishonim and put it together, put it into dialogue with Proudhon, quoted, of course, from the original French, with Locke, with Marx, and brought all of that Torah learning to bear on a question of economic theory. Is the Torah capitalist? That's really the question that he asked. You could ask it differently. Is the Torah socialist? His answer to both of those questions would have been no. But of course, as you know, it's always more complicated than that. But this is really thrilling to me. So I discovered that decades earlier, Rilakanthina had been contributing to volumes on Jewish thought. The volume was actually called Hagut Ivrit BaAmerika, and it contained articles by lots of Jewish thinkers from across the religious and political spectrums, contributing articles on Jewish thought in America, all written in Hebrew. And it turns out there were a number of volumes, and it was really a very impressive collection. And Rilakanthina, who had been a Rosh Kollel, had been asked to and had been contributing to these things. But of course, he had been contributing erudite Torah articles on issues of social import. And I say this is challenging, erudition with a purpose. It's challenging for a few reasons, for me at least. First of all, erudition is seductive. Knowledge is intoxicating. For someone who lives a life of a mind or just enjoys life of a mind, there's a thrill from just learning new things, learning things that I never knew existed, an insight, an idea into fields that I might be familiar with, or discovering a whole new field, discovering whole new sets of questions and possibilities that were just new, not new to the world necessarily, but new to me. That, I think, is it's like a drug sometimes. If there's been a long time without new ideas, it's stultifying. You need ideas, you need knowledge, you need to keep accumulating knowledge just to keep vibrant. It's addictive in that way. So it's hard to stop learning without any particular goal in mind. Sometimes it's hard to stop learning, hard to stop reading. Second of all, knowledge is powerful. I don't mean that in any Foucauldian sense. I mean that in a simple sense. You can gain political standing, social standing, by knowing things. And third of all, some people have actually figured out how to make money off of knowing stuff. I happen to have a job where a lot of my success in terms of the profession involves digging up information that other people don't know, or coming up with an interpretation that hasn't been considered before. No matter how arcane it is, if it's new, it's valuable. And that's, I think, the danger that Rilakanthina is often warning against. A knowledge for knowledge's sake. Knowledge because no one else knows it, and I do, so isn't that cool? And Rilakanthina would say, no, that's not at all cool. That's really not the goal of knowledge, certainly not with Torah, but not with anything else. So I want to just actually mention a couple of ways in which he indicated this, that knowledge had to be for some sake. And then we'll move on to the topic of the Shir. So first of all, those early articles. In the 60s, you have to realize in the 60s, Rav Lichtenstein, at the end of the 60s, he was in his mid-30s. He was still a young man. And he had written articles on Kofino Toa Midat Stom, topics like the halachic perspective on individual rights, the case for interaction between religion and state, which is not your intuitive position, the question of whether there's a realm of ethics outside of halacha, the case of Brother Daniel, and the question of what it means to a Jew to be a Jew, and so on. These are core social issues for Jews and for Westerners. And in all of these cases, he was taking part in think tanks within YU, at the Annenberg Center in Philadelphia. He was part of thinking circles and bringing to bear Torah knowledge on social topics and trying to make the point, implicitly, I think, that, in other words, I don't know if he's actually explicitly wrote this, that someone who knows Torah deeply has something to contribute not only to the Torah world but to the broader world about important issues. That there was wisdom that could be gained from the Torah that could be brought to bear on these topics. But it's not only that he thought that learning could be mobilized for the sake of important issues, at least outside of Torah, he thought that learning that wasn't valuable was actually worth nothing at all. There was Dr. Holtz might remember this, when we were new on campus, when I was new on the faculty here at least, Rav Lichtenstein came to YU and had a public dialogue about education. He rankled some of the members of the faculty by questioning whether all literature was appropriate to be taught at Yeshiva College, and certainly whether it needed to be taught. But he thought there was some literature among the canon of English literature, without question, stuff that he has read, but he didn't think it necessarily needed to be taught or could be taught in a Yeshiva College general education course. Without taking a stand on the particular examples or the particular question that he raised, I think he was making a very important point. If you're educating someone, not all text, not all knowledge is equal. One has to think carefully about what one is teaching and why. What's the purpose of this education? Why are we studying? Why are we studying it all? And once we can formulate that, maybe we can try to figure out how we can best accomplish that education. The same is true of whole fields. The year before I started my graduate program in ancient Near Eastern studies, I was in Gush with Shira, Rav Lichtenstein, before the end of the year, called me over. I had never really talked to him about my academic plans, but he knew. He was actually, as you probably know, he was very well informed about students in the yeshiva, whether or not the students thought that he needed to be well informed about their particular circumstances. He said that he actually knew some of the people that I was studying with. And he said, but you have to remember that T.S. Eliot studied Sanskrit for a few years at Harvard, and he stopped, at least in Rav Lichtenstein's version, which I haven't been able to verify, he stopped because he was becoming too seduced with Sanskrit as a language and Eastern wisdom, and was starting to forget that one of the reasons he was studying Eastern wisdom was to better illuminate Western philosophy. And his point to me was, you're studying the ancient Near East, you should study it as well as possible. But keep in mind that you're studying it for an understanding of Tanakh. Never lose sight of what the Ikar is and what the Tafel is. In a similar vein, a friend actually once asked him in a public forum why he and Rabbi Soloveitchik constantly quoted people who actually have been dead for a century. Constantly quoting philosophers and English literature that's written 19th century, 18th century, why not keep up with what's going on? No philosopher today is actually interacting that much with Kierkegaard. So why is that your lodestone when you enter into discussions of the intersection between religion and philosophy? And Rav Lichtenstein said, first he said, well, there is an issue of Girsa Diankuta, what we've learned when we were children, and it stays with you in a more powerful way. But then he said, there's also the issue that, by his impressions, Foucault and Derrida were far less valuable to a religious thinker than Kant and Kierkegaard. And it was actually striking to some of us in the room that he could rattle off names like Foucault and Derrida. It was not clear that he knew. These people, remember, were writing in the 70s and 80s, long after his general education, in a formal sense, had concluded. But it also meant, more strikingly, that look, just keeping up with what's going on in philosophy is not inherently a goal in and of itself. If it's not valuable for me, then I'll go back to what I think is valuable. Kierkegaard, you know, you might say he's old-fashioned, but if that's what's useful for me as a religious thinker, then that's what I'm going to interact with. That's what I'm going to refer to when I think about religious thinking. There are lots of other examples that I won't go into now, but this is an overarching theme in his life and in his teaching, that learning, Torah, and in different ways other fields, had to be al manat la'asot. There had to be some value to this that could be pressed into action. If learning wasn't for a purpose, then it was actually worthless. So I haven't had a lot of direct contact with Vilchansi in recent years. This was a long time already. Many of my friends who are in academia have actually had complex relationships with him. He didn't reject, but he didn't fully embrace academic study of Talmud, to take one example, but Jewish studies more broadly. Something that he certainly didn't reject, but also had something of an uneasy or complex attitude toward it. But to me, he was and remains something of a lighthouse. Both illuminates a path, but also warns of dangers. As someone involved in education, I think it's important to always ask, am I getting wrapped up in learning and teaching because it's just interesting? Or is there actually some goal in mind in learning this particular topic or investigating that particular issue? And as responsibilities multiply in life, as they inevitably do, it's very seductive to feel that busyness is in and of itself a badge of pride. If I'm very busy, everyone, you ask someone in the street, hey, I'm very busy. No time for anything. There are people I know who actually seem to have very little going on in their lives, but if you ask them how they're doing, they're very busy. Busyness is a badge of pride. I'm obviously important if I'm very busy. And I think one of the things that I try to remind myself always is that you might be busy, but you have to ask what you're putting on the schedule first. Busyness can't be an excuse not to do the things that are actually important in life. So the shiur on the morning of Yom HaAtzmaut was obviously something that he put on the schedule first, and for those of us who got to sit in the Beit Midrash and listen, it was certainly time well spent. Those are high standards to set, so I'll hope that the remainder of our time here can be judged at least to be a partial success by those standards. All right, so having said that, according to a braita quoted in the Babli, quoted in Baba Batra, Sidran Shal Ketuvim, Rut V'Sefer Tehillim, V'Yov V'Mishlei, Kohelet Shir HaShirim V'Kinot, Daniel U'Megilat Esther, Ezra V'Divrei Hayamim. It's the last three books of Ketuvim, Esther, Ezra, and Divrei Hayamim. Clearly, the books are arranged chronologically based on the events they describe, but there might also be ideological significance to arranging them this way, and that's what I want to explore this afternoon. In order to explore that, in order to elaborate a little bit on what I mean, I need to actually step back for a moment, but really only for a brief moment, and remind us all of the relationship between Megillat Esther and the story of Yosef. On the sheet that's going around, on the back, I'm not going to go through this, but on the back of the sheet, there's a chart and then some bullet points, just to remind you of the very clear ways in which Megillat Esther alludes to the story of Yosef, with verbal allusions and with thematic allusions. And I don't want to belabor that point now. I think, first of all, it's well known, and second of all, it would take us too far afield. But I do want to think about the implications of that. So one of the key lessons that the author of Esther presumably wants to draw by alluding to the story of Yosef is a political notion, a political thought, that a Jew, Yosef, whose Jewish identity is hidden, who lives and operates in a foreign court, can actually save his or her kinspeople, kinsfolk, and that it might be specifically because his identity, his Jewish identity, is hidden, that he's able to do that. Right? And as Yosef is able to be in a position to save his brother, specifically because, to all appearances, he's no longer Jewish. Right? Now, it's not a secret to the Egyptians that he's Jewish, at least it wasn't when he began. I don't know who remembers that, but he didn't hide that fact, and that's actually how he's introduced to Paro to begin with. But certainly visitors don't know that he's Jewish. We know from the brothers that they had no idea that he spoke Hebrew or whatever Canaanite dialect you would have called it at that time. There was a Melitz Binotam. There's a translator. He is, to all appearances, Egyptian. He dresses like an Egyptian, speaks like an Egyptian, is married to an Egyptian girl, and presumably raises his kids as Egyptians, although they have Semitic names that we'll come back to soon. So the author of Esther presses that into service and says, look, that's what Yosef was able to do. And Yosef, how could you say anything bad about Yosef? So if Yosef was able to do it, that's a good model for someone like Esther to also be in the foreign court, Jewish identity hidden, and specifically because her Jewish identity is hidden, she can actually work to save the Jews in ways that someone whose Jewish identity is not hidden, even someone like Mordechai, could not accomplish. But one could imagine someone objecting to that. If that's one of the claims made by the author of Esther, one could imagine someone objecting. Someone might say, well, yeah, that's true. Yosef did save his brother, save his father, save the family. That's true. But that's not the end of the story. There is an aftermath to the story, and doesn't that actually undermine that thesis? Because Yosef is successful only within his own lifetime, actually, at securing favorable treatment for his brothers. After that, Yosef dies. When Yosef dies, well, we all know what happens. V'yakom melech hadash ha-Mitzrayim, asher lo yada Yosef. And it turns out, all of Yosef's successes bear fruit only for his own time. As soon as he's gone, as soon as he passes from the scene, that it was very tenuous what he was able to do. And when he's not there personally to make sure that the Jews are in good standing, it turns out that the Egyptians can turn against them. So one might turn to the author of Esther and say, of what value is that? So great, Esther and Mordechai have saved the Jews. But that's good for one generation, maybe. What about when there'll be a melech hadash al paras, a shelo yada et Mordechai v'Esther, and then what? Then what's going to happen? Now the author of Esther, the book of Esther itself, might actually answer a rather cynical answer. It might say, look, that's life in Galut. Life in Galut means surviving generation to generation. The end of Esther says there were taxes. Taxes are one of the two things that we can be sure will never go away. Right? In other words, the author of Esther says, at the end of the book, this book of redemption, where are we? We're back to normal life, but maybe that's called redemption in Galut. In diaspora, what you can hope for is to survive to live another day. That's what Esther and Mordechai have accomplished, right? The sum total of the redemption in Megillat Esther is that the Jews weren't massacred. That's not setting a very high bar for what counts as Geula, but the author of Esther might say, but that's life in Galut. Life in Galut is that if we survive to the next generation, then we've done a pretty good job. Is that all that can be done? Well, it's possible. But a canonical perspective, and it's reading Tanakh, not just stopping after Esther Perek Yud and saying, okay, we've gotten to the end of the book, but reading on might suggest a different answer. And I wonder, but certainly can't establish, whether the people who put Tanakh together actually intended you to continue from Esther into Ezra and Nehemiah. So there might be a different answer to the question, what will be when there's a Melech Hadash al Paras if you continue after Megillat Esther and read on? Because right afterwards, you get to the story of Ezra and Nehemiah. To put it in historical terms, the king in Esther is Ahasuerus, Xerxes. Xerxes dies in 465 BCE. Okay, so what happens when there's a Melech Hadash? Well, the Melech Hadash, it turns out, is Artaxasta, Artaxerxes. He comes to the throne in 465. That's the king under whom Ezra and Nehemiah operate. So what happens when there's a Melech Hadash al Paras, Shelo Yadat Mordechai v'Esther? Well, we have an answer in the book. What does happen? Just 15 years after the end of Megillat Esther, which ends in the 12th year of Achashverosh, in the 7th year of Artaxasta, Ezra organizes a mass aliyah from Bavel, from Paras, to Yehud, to the Persian province of Yehud, to the city of Yerushalayim. And 13 years later than that, 445, Nehemiah, an important member of the court of Artaxasta, asks for permission to leave and to go help his brothers rebuild Yerushalayim. So, in theory, within the terms of history set by the Megillah, Mordechai and Esther might well still be alive. Right? I don't know how old they were exactly. But this is not long after the end of that story. But Ezra and Nehemiah represent a very different response to the kind of threats that we read about in Megillat Esther. A very stark opposition to what we have in the Megillah. Whereas Esther, like Yosef, advocated basically manipulating the foreign court, operating within the foreign court in order to save the Jews, Ezra and Nehemiah says something much more, maybe you might say simpler, but much more radical. Say, why do we have to stay here? Why do we have to stay and operate through the Persian court? We could simply leave and go back to Yehuda. Now, it's not simple. Of course, in Yosef's time, there was a famine. And in Esther's time, or Ezra and Nehemiah's time, there is no dichotomy between Galut and Israel, because Israel, even if you go back to Yerushalayim and go back to Yehud, it turns out you're still in the Persian Empire. Right? Yehud is a Persian province. They haven't escaped Galut by going to Israel, but they have left the court and gone off to where they think they can build some sort of autonomous society. Now, some have suggested that the Torah itself sets up a contrast to Yosef. Who comes after Yosef?
Moshe.
In a lot of ways, Moshe stands in opposition to Yosef. Yosef postpones reality, right? But Moshe says, so let's not live in this reality. Moshe and Yosef are in a number of ways opposites. Yosef is born an Israelite in Canaan and integrates himself into the foreign palace, right? Integrates himself into the Egyptian palace. Moshe, of course, raised in the Egyptian palace, leaves, breaks out to go be an Israelite. Yosef works within the system, giving up his Jewish identity to a large degree. Moshe breaks free personally. Right, running away, setting out his own identity. Yosef enslaves people to Paro, right? A part that we don't reflect on a lot. But Yosef actually engineers the enslavement of the entire Egyptian population to Paro. Moshe works to free slaves from Paro. Going back to the names, Yosef's names his kids two really remarkable names. Right, what does Menashe mean? Thanking God for helping me to forget my father's house. That's really astounding. And Ephraim, which is the other side of the coin, thank God for helping me to prosper here. Right? Called Beit Amali, but to prosper here. Moshe, sometimes Yosef has said through the names of his kids, thank you for letting me leave there and establish myself here. What about Moshe? Moshe leaves Egypt, goes to Midian, and what does he name his kid?
Gershom.
Right? Because he's a Ger in Eretz Nochria. Where? Which land is he a ger in?
He was a ger.
He's no less of a ger in Midian, right? Moshe, at least as he discovers his identity, is a foreigner no matter where he goes. In fact, one of the things that we can say with certainty by the end of Moshe's life is that he never finds a home. Right? He never was at home in Egypt, caught between his two identities there, goes to Midian, maybe had hopes to find a home there. Didn't happen, goes back to Egypt, leaves Egypt, never makes it to what he thought was going to be his homeland, never finds the rootedness that Yosef says he had Yosef had it in his new home. So Yosef and Moshe are, in a sense, two models of Jews in the court of Egypt. Yosef says, this is where we can do a lot of good. By being as powerful as possible in the court, we can do good, not only for the Egyptians, but for the Jews. And Moshe says, yeah, but then we're always going to be within the Egyptian system. We're never going to be our own people. He leaves, goes to foreign land, takes the people along. So the author of Esther, if he attempts to resurrect the model of Yosef, he's saying, Yosef's the right model for us now, right? We need a kind of hero who says, look, this is the reality. There's no way out. So we need someone who can work within the system, work within the palace, to do good for the Jews. Redemption, Geulah, in a deep sense, is just not a viable option. So all we can hope for is someone who can help us survive to live to see another day. But not everyone would have wanted to stop the story then. That's really it? So all you can hope for is to live to see another generation? But if you want to continue the story, then you need to come up with the fourth part of our analogy, right? So Yosef is to Esther as Moshe is to who? And we need someone else to take the role of Moshe. And I think the suggestion is that Ezra and Nehemiah are meant to fill that role if you read the end of Tanakh as a whole. So as Yosef was able to do a lot, but never able to actually affect radical change, on the contrary, brought the Jews down to Egypt, Esther and Mordechai are able to do a lot, but they can never actually break out. We need someone else to do that. So if you read it that way, then Esther can be read as a preamble to the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah. Esther and Mordechai can delay the inevitable. But Haman was entirely random. He was set off by absolutely nothing at all. An entirely minor offense set off a genocidal plot. What's to prevent that from happening again? There's nothing at all that can prevent that from happening again. And next time, what if you're not so fortunate to have a closet Jew as the queen? That's really fortuitous. But next time there's some genocidal plot that circulates through the Persian Empire, who's going to save you then? The only solution then, as Ezra Nehemiah says, is to not be here next time that happens. If we're not here, then we don't have to worry about it. That's not so simple. The Ramban actually talks in the beginning of his Chidushim on Masechet Megillah, why that's not so simple. But I'll put that aside. Put aside for his reason. He just points out that there are no walls in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was very vulnerable, and Yerushalayim is part of the Persian Empire. So you'd be massacred in Yerushalayim, just the same way you'd be massacred in Shushan. But in any event, Ezra and Nehemiah would say, being part of the administration in Shushan is not enough. When Nehemiah hears about the degraded status of the city of Yerushalayim and the people in Yerushalayim, these are the sources you have at the beginning of the source sheet. I can figure out which one's the first page. Nehemiah narrates that he was there in Shushan, in Shushan Abira, and he's told about the terrible state of affairs in Yerushalayim. And when he hears about this, he, like Mordechai in Pasuk Dalet, reacts with sort of typical avilut. Kishom'i et hadverim ha'ele yashavti v'yevkeh v'et abla yamim v'hitzam u'mitpolel lefnei Elohei Hashamayim. But unlike Mordechai, first of all, he prays already, right? But it's Halel. Nowhere in Esther do we talk about Tfilah, which opens up a whole other topic about Esther, but Esther is an explicitly non-religious book, by which I mean the author takes pains to not say anything religious. It's not just that it happens not to come up, but when Esther says, Lech knosu kol yudim etzumo alai shloshet yamim, and fails to say v'hitpalelu, that's not an accident. And there are a number of examples where the author seems to be very clearly, not about Mordechai and Esther, but the author seems to be very clearly not saying anything religious in his telling of the story. So Nehemiah has no such qualms. Nehemiah bet palel, bet abla, bet yitzam bet palel, afnei Elohei Hashamayim, mentions God. But then, further and more importantly, unlike Mordechai, and more unlike Esther more specifically, when the king asks him what's wrong, at the beginning of Perek Bet, which is the next paragraph you have, when the king says, Madua panecha ra'im, batayin chacholeh, something must be wrong, what's troubling you, Nehemiah says, in language that sounds familiar, Im al melech tov, im itav avdachal lefanecha, but rather than saying, I want you to help, he says, I want you to send me. Ashet tishvacheni al Yehuda, el ir kivrot avotai ve'evnena. So unlike anything Esther ever asked for, he says, I want to get out of here. It's true I'm a high-ranking person in the palace, but I don't just want to use that position to manipulate you to help save the Jews. I want to leave. I want you to reassign me. I want you to send me to Yehuda, to Ir Kivrot Avotai, to Yerushalayim, and I want to go build Yerushalayim personally. There's also imagery, I won't belabor this point, but there's imagery of Yitzhak Mitzrayim in the story of Ezra. Not a ton, but there is some imagery of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. I included just one pasuk here. When Ezra finally tells in Parakhet of Sefer Ezra, when he finally tells about his own march to Yehuda, to Yerushalayim, V'nis'ah min ahar ahava, you have it in the middle of the page, B'shnei masar l'chodesh harishon, l'lecha Yerushalayim. So he waits, it turns, from the story it's clear that he's been waiting at the Ahava River till the 12th of Nisan, to finally set out on his march. He's been waiting for Leviim. Now, he knows there are Leviim in Yerushalayim already. He doesn't need Leviim. It's possible, not certain, that he needed Levium for his march. Seeing his march as a second Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the first march of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, of course, had Levium accompanying them, guiding the way, so he needs Levium as well. And then he says, V'yad Eloheinu aita aleinu, v'yatzilinim kafoyev orev al aderech. The hand of God was with us. The hand of God, of course, is a very, very prominent motif in Yitzhak Mitzrayim. But I won't belabor that point now. The key is that there are social and religious overtones to what Ezra's doing, right? We're marching as a community to Yerushalayim to escape the old world order and to establish a new one, off in Yerushalayim. When Ezra and Nehemiah are read immediately after Esther, I think the reader can't help but hear echoes of that same progression. As Yosef does what he does, but needs to be followed up by Moshe, Esther and Mordechai do what they do, kol hakavod lahem, but rather than just telling stories like Esther over and over of near misses, of narrow escapes, it needs to be followed up by actions, decisions like those of Ezra and Nehemiah. In other words, the only solution to the problem of Esther, the only long-term solution to the problem of Esther, is the solution proffered by Ezra and Nehemiah. So don't stick around anymore. If you go back to Yerushalayim, we have a long-term solution here. I want to emphasize, I don't think that's the perspective of the author of Esther. I don't think that the author of Esther thought that we needed Ezra and Nehemiah. The author of Esther, I think, actually thinks that this is the kind of life, the kind of gula that we can hope for in Galut. We can hope to survive one generation at a time and then hope to do it again next generation. That's really all you can hope for. But at least some people didn't leave it alone in that way and said, you can't leave Esther by itself. Esther, if left alone, you might come to that conclusion, but it has to be followed up. I want to emphasize that because there are contemporary readings of Megillat Esther that actually think that the book of Esther criticizes Mordechai and Esther and criticizes the Jews for being in Shushan. I see none of that in the Megillah itself. The Megillah, I think, clearly thinks that Mordechai and Esther are heroes, to be lauded, to be praised, to be celebrated, not to be criticized or satirized for the fact that they're in Shushan HaBira. But there are people who argue that it's inconceivable that any book in Tanakh could simply live with Galut as a reality. And so every book in Tanakh must really be arguing that you need to move to Israel. It's not an uncommon motif in Tanakh, but Megillat Esther, I think, actually is one book that really very clearly simply takes exile as for granted. This is the life that we have. We need to figure out how to navigate this kind of life. It's not to be celebrated necessarily, but it's also not to be lamented at every turn. It's life. Life is what it is, and we need to learn how to live in this life. But Ezra and Nehemiah say, well, there is an alternative. We just don't have to stay in this life. All right. I want to conclude with reference to a sugya that was one that Rav Lichtenstein talked about often, about Kedusha Rishonah and Kedusha Shniyah, which is referred to in the Gemara on a number of occasions. But it's the psak of the Rambam that's best known about Kedusha Rishonah, Kedusha Shniyah. As you know, Kedusha Rishonah, according to almost all the Rishonim, and it's really virtually explicit in the Gemara, Kedusha Rishonah refers to Kibush Yehoshua, the first time the land of Israel was sanctified. Kedusha Shniyah refers to Ole Bavel, in other words, including, culminating in Ezra and Nehemiah. There is the opinion of Rabbi Nechanano that Kedusha Rishonah is actually Avraham, and Kedusha Shniyah is Yehoshua, but it really doesn't fit into the Sugyot well at all. So, any event, the Rambam doesn't understand it that way. And the Rambam, when he paskins in Perek Vav of Hilchot Beit HaBechira, that Kedusha Rishonah, this is the opinion of most Rishonim, that Kedusha Rishonah was Kedusha L'Sha'ata V'lo Kedusha L'Atid Lavo, that it was in the end of the day ephemeral. The Kedusha accomplished by Yehoshua evaporated at Galut Bavel, whereas Kedusha Shniyah, the second Kedusha, the second sanctification of the land, accomplished by Ole Bavel, was permanent, even after Churban Bayit Sheni and Bar Kokhba and so on. And the Rambam says, "V'lama ani omer b'mikdash b'Yerushalayim shekedusha rishonah kitshat tam latid lavo, u'kedusha sh'ara et Yisrael l'inyan shvi'it ma'asur v'kayotzeh v'en lo kitshat latid lavo, l'fi shekedushat ha'mikdash b'Yerushalayim b'fnei ha'shechinah. Ha'shechinah ina b'teila." All right, that's with regard to kedusha b'Yerushalayim. "Aval chiyuv ha'aretz b'shvi'it ma'asrot, eino ela m'pnei shu kibush rabim. Chayvan shenilkecha ha'aretz midehem, batel ha'kibush." V'niftara min haTorah min haMa'asrot min haShvi'it sharei ina Eretz Yisrael. V'kivan shala Ezra v'kidusha lo kidusha b'kibush ela b'chazaka she'achziku ba. L'fichach kol makom she'achziku bo ole bavel v'nitkadesh b'kidushat Ezra hashniya harei hu mekudash hayom v'af al pi shenilkecha haaretz mimenu v'chayav b'shvi'it v'maasrot al haderech she'biarnu b'ilchot truma. And Rabbi Soloveitchik in Ala Tshuva actually goes in a slightly different direction. It says the difference between Yoshua and Olei Bavel is that Yoshua never conquered Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was only conquered by David. Yerushalayim was only the end of the Kedusha Rishona. Whereas Kedusha Shnia focused on Yerushalayim. It started with Yerushalayim and it grew out from there. And he thinks that a Kedusha that begins with Yerushalayim is more permanent. That's certainly... is what the Rambam talks about in Halachat Tetvav. But in Halachat Tetzayin, the Rambam explicitly goes in a different direction. And remember, the Rabbi Soloveitchik said that in Ala Tshuva, not in a Shir Yomi. But the Rambam says something different. There's a difference between Kedusha accomplished by Kibush and Kedusha accomplished by Chazakah. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword, and that's true about Kedusha as well. So Yeshua comes in and conquers the land. He uses the sword. That's the only thing he uses. Even this peace treaty is signed under threat of a sword. And if that's the way you live, then that's the way you die. And Yeshua conquers it, and at last, I don't want to trivialize it, it lasts for 600 years, but then it's conquered by someone else. And when it's conquered by someone else, that's it. Everything that Yeshua has accomplished has now been erased. Anything accomplished, to put it differently, anything accomplished by force alone is by its nature ephemeral. That's what the Rambam's basically saying. In a shiur that Rav Lichtenstein gave on Yom HaAtzmaut in 1968, 1 year after the Six-Day War, Rav Lichtenstein worried aloud, very interestingly, that Israel was becoming too dependent, both in a practical sense and a spiritual sense, on its military might. In other words, not only is it practically dependent on its military might, which might be necessary, but for its own identity, it was becoming too dependent on its military might. And as a corrective, he actually pointed to a speech that General Rabin had given the year before, right after the Six-Day War, in June of 1967, when he was given an honorary doctorate at the Hebrew University. And you have excerpts from, you have the Hebrew excerpt at the bottom of the first page and an English translation at the top of the second page. This is just one paragraph. It's not a very long speech. You can find it at the Rabin Center website. But General Rabin, who had just overseen the Six-Day War, an absolutely astounding military victory, comes to Har HaTzofim, which is interesting because there are, for those students of Tanakh, there are military associations with Har HaTzofim, but I don't know whether those were conscious in his mind or not. But the speech is at Har HaTzofim. He says, "Ha'am kulo after the Six-Day War, amad nif'am, v'rabim af bachu, l'shmo ha'besura kibush ha'ir ha'atika." The nation as a whole was overwhelmed. Many cried at hearing the news of the capture of the old city. And he talks about how the hardened soldiers, who are not prone to emotion, broke down when they realized what had just happened. But afa pichin mitkalina anu yoter v'yoter b'tofa'a muzara b'kerev adat ha'lochamim atzmam. Even soldiers, he says, we see something weird, something a little strange. What's going on with them? Einem yicholim l'smoach b'lev shalem. They can't fully rejoice, and more than a little sorrow and a little shock permeates their celebration. And there are some who don't celebrate at all. How could that be? The warriors in the front lines, right? They saw with their own eyes not only the glory of victory, but also its price. their friends, their comrades who fell beside them, bleeding, and and the suffering they saw of the enemy, which of course was necessary, they would say, but is terrible. And how could they celebrate wholeheartedly when seeing such sights? And then he says, "Yitachen sha'am ha'yehudi lo chunach v'lo hurgal l'chush etzimchat ha'kibush v'hamnatzeach. L'chein mitkabel ha'davar b'rikshut muravim, b'regashot muravim." It could be, he says, that the Jewish people as a whole just doesn't know how to celebrate military victory in and of itself. And that's not something that the Jewish people delights in an unadulterated way. It's important, of course, we celebrate it. Of course, the results are important. Not just Yerushalayim, but the rest of what happened in the Six-Day War. Of course, it's all important, and of course, we celebrate it. But it's hard for Jews, General Rabin says, it's hard for Jews to look at military victory alone and say, this is something that we're proud of. It's something that we're happy about, in large part because the alternative is a catastrophe. But it's something that's complicated. It's something that there is suffering on the other side, as well as suffering on our side. And the general, the Ramatkal says that that it could never have been pure satisfaction and pure joy. That's a very, I think, a crucial point for what we've been discussing here today. Ezra and Nehemiah and their predecessors part ways with Moshe and Yehoshua in how they establish a Jewish land. So in a sense, we've been talking about how Ezra and Nehemiah, in our grand analogy, are standing in the tradition of Moshe. Right? So we have Esther and Mordechai like Yosef, Ezra and Nehemiah like Moshe and Yehoshua. But Moshe and Yehoshua, well, they're the ones who effected Kedusha Rishona through Kibush. It was, again, long-lasting. It lasted for 600 years. That's, to put it in perspective, 600 years is longer than the time since the Europeans discovered that there was a whole Western Hemisphere. So it's a very long time that Yehoshua succeeded in establishing Kedusha Rishona, but it came to an end. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And the Assyrians and the Babylonians had more powerful swords than the Jews. So Yehoshua was successful, and then he was not successful. But there's a Kedusha Shnia. It starts with Shesh Batzar and Zerubbabel, and it culminates in the movements of Ezra and Nehemiah in the following century. It was a trickle. It was never a flood. It was tens of thousands. It was never millions. We're not talking about a mass exodus. But those people arrived, and they came, and they built. They decided they couldn't live generation to generation in exile, just waiting to see what the next threat would be and how they would manage to survive it, who the next Melech Hadash would be, and what he had forgotten and what he might remember. They decided to use the political clout that they had, Imal HaMelech Tov, Imitav Avdecha Lefanecha, Asher Teshlacheni El Yehuda, El Erek Yivrot Avotai Ve'evnena. At the same time, what Nehemiah asks for, when you look at what he asks for, at the same time he's asking to return to the old, send me Teshlacheni El Yehuda, El Erek Yivrot Avotai, send me to the city in which my ancestors are buried. He wants to return to the old, and he wants to build the new, Ve'evnena. He's not just looking to go back, he's looking to build on the past, and literally build, and figuratively build, a new future. They want to return, and they want to forge ahead. In our days, it might not be religiosity that's needed in Israel. Religiosity is perhaps rampant in Israel. It's a Jewish culture that needs to be built in Israel. What's needed is a sense that Judaism is more than just a checklist of what may or may not be done or must be done. But Judaism is a way of life and a way of thought that's animated by a rich and diverse tradition, but that people who fully soak in that tradition are not held back by that tradition, but can build on it. Again, to return to Rav Lichtenstein's early articles we're doing. Having spent his decades mastering Shas and Poskim, he said, great, now what's the relationship between religion and state? What are the rights of the individual? Are there ethics outside of halacha? Big questions that can be tackled once you've absorbed the Jewish tradition. The Jewish tradition doesn't mean we return to the 18th century, return to the 3rd century, return to biblical times. It means I've absorbed that all, and now I'm ready to build on it, to move forward. I want to go back to Ir Kivot Avotai, Ve'evnena. I want to build it up. We need a community that's steeped in Judaism, but not burdened by it. By a community that sees the past as a privilege that we're lucky enough to inherit, that we're proud to bear as we go into the future. We need a community also that has a sword, that knows how to use a sword, but doesn't necessarily delight in it. Has a strong sense of identity and the courage to forge ahead. The Kedusha that's created by a community centered around a spiritual and cultural Judaism, build a community in the land of Israel and emanating from there, that Kedusha is certainly Kedusha L'Sha'atah V'Kedusha L'Atid Lavo. Chag Sameach.